Wentworth went with him again and took advantage of the opportunity to make careful observations of children in Ugandan villages. Even in a culture where women share mothering duties for all the children in the extended family household, Ainsworth observed a special bond between a child and his own mother. The mother was much more effective as a secure base than were other women. Ainsworth then moved to the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and after that to the University of Virginia, where she thought about how to test Bowlby's ideas and her own about the mother-child relationship. In Bowlby's cybernetic theory, the action is in the changes. You can't just watch a child play. You have to look at how the exploration and safety goals shift in response to changing conditions. So Ainsworth developed a little drama, later called The Strange Situation, and cast the child in the starring role. In essence, she recreated the experiments in which Harlow had placed monkeys in an open room with novel toys. In the first scene, the mother and her child enter a comfortable room full of toys. Most children in the experiment soon crawl or toddle off to explore. In scene two, a friendly woman enters, talks with the mother for a few minutes, and then joins the child in play. In scene three, the mother gets up and leaves the child alone for a few minutes with the stranger. In scene four, she returns and the stranger leaves. In scene five, the mother leaves again and the child is all alone in the room. In scene six, the stranger returns, and in scene seven, the mother returns for good. The play is designed to ratchet up the child's stress level in order to see how the child's attachment system manages the scene changes. Ainsworth found three common patterns of managing. In about two-thirds of American children, the system does just what Bowlby said it should, that is, shift smoothly between play and security seeking as the situation changes. Children following this pattern, called secure attachment, reduce or stop their play when their mothers leave, and then show anxiety which the stranger cannot fully relieve. In the two scenes where mom returns, these children show delight, often moving toward her or touching her to reestablish contact with their secure base. But then they quickly settle down and return to play. In the other third of children, the scene changes are more awkward. These children have one of two types of insecure attachment. The majority of them don't seem to care very much whether mom comes or goes, although subsequent physiological research showed that they are indeed distressed by the separation. Rather, these children seem to be suppressing their distress by trying to manage it on their own instead of relying upon mom for comfort. Ainsworth called this pattern avoidant attachment. The remaining children, about 12% in the United States, are anxious and clingy throughout the study. They become extremely upset when separated from mom. They sometimes resist her efforts to comfort them when she returns, and they never fully settle down to play in the unfamiliar room. Ainsworth called this pattern resistant. Ainsworth first thought these differences were caused entirely by good or bad mothering. She observed mothers at home and found that those who were warm and highly responsive to their children were most likely to have children who showed secure attachment in the strange situation. These children had learned that they could count on their mothers and were therefore the most bold and confident. Mothers who were aloof and unresponsive were more likely to have avoidant children, who had learned not to expect much help and comfort from mom. Mothers whose responses were erratic and unpredictable were more likely to have resistant children, who had learned that their efforts to elicit comfort sometimes paid off, but sometimes not. But whenever I hear about correlations between mother and child, I'm skeptical. Twin studies almost always show that personality traits are due more to genetics than to parenting. Maybe it's just that happy women, those who won the cortical lottery, are warm and loving, and they pass on their happy genes to their children, who then show up as securely attached. Or maybe the correlation runs in reverse. Children do have stable inborn temperaments, sunny, cranky, or anxious, and the sunny ones are just so much fun that their mothers want to be more responsive. My skepticism is bolstered by the fact that studies done after Ainsworth's home study have generally found only small correlations between mothers' responsiveness and the attachment style of their children. On the other hand, twin studies have found that genes play only a small role in determining attachment style. So now we have a real puzzle, a trait that correlates weakly with mothering and weakly with genes. Where does it come from? Bowlby's cybernetic theory forces us to think outside the usual nature-nurture dichotomy. You have to see attachment style as a property that emerges gradually during thousands of interactions. A child with a particular, genetically influenced temperament makes bids for protection. A mother with a particular, genetically influenced temperament responds, or doesn't respond, based on her mood, on how overworked she is, or on what child care guru she has been reading. No one event is particularly important, but over time the child builds up what Bowlby called an internal working model of himself, his mother, and their relationship. If the model says that mom is always there for you, you'll be bolder in your play and explorations. Round after round, predictable and reciprocal interactions build trust and strengthen the relationship. Children with sunny dispositions who have happy mothers are almost certain to play the game well and develop a secure attachment style. But a dedicated mother can overcome either her own or her child's less pleasant disposition and foster a secure internal working model of their relationship. Everything I have reported above is true for fathers too, but most children in all cultures spend more time with their mothers. It's not just for children. When I started writing this chapter, I planned to review attachment theory in a page or two and then move on to the stuff that we adults really care about. When we hear the word love, we think of romantic love. We might hear an occasional song about love between parents and children on a country music radio station, but anywhere else on the dial, love means the kind of love you fall into and then struggle to hold onto. The more I delved into the research, however, the more I realized that Harlow, Bowlby, and Ainsworth can help us understand grown-up love. See for yourself. Which of the following statements best describes you in romantic relationships? Number 1. I find it relatively easy to get close to others and am comfortable depending on them and having them depend on me. I don't often worry about being abandoned or about someone getting too close to me. Number 2. I am somewhat uncomfortable being close to others. I find it difficult to trust them completely, difficult to allow myself to depend on them. I am nervous when anyone gets too close, and often love partners want me to be more intimate than I feel comfortable being. Number 3. I find that others are reluctant to get as close as I would like. I often worry that my partner doesn't really love me or won't want to stay with me. I want to merge completely with another person, and this desire sometimes scares people away. The attachment researchers Cindy Hazan and Phil Shaver developed this simple test to see whether Ainsworth's three styles were still at work when adults try to form relationships. They are. Some people change style as they grow up, but the great majority of adults choose the descriptor that matched the way they were as a child. The three choices correspond to Ainsworth's secure, avoidant, and resistant patterns. Internal working models are fairly stable, though not unchangeable, guiding people in their most important relationships throughout their lives. And just as secure babies are happier and more well-adjusted, secure adults enjoy happier, longer relationships as well as lower rates of divorce. But does adult romantic love really grow out of the same psychological system that attaches children to their mothers? To find out, Hazan traced the process by which childhood attachment changes with age. Bowlby had been specific about the four defining features of attachment relationships. Number 1. Proximity maintenance. The child wants and strives to be near the parent. Number 2. Separation distress. Self-explanatory. Number 3. Safe haven. The child, when frightened or distressed, comes to the parent for comfort. Number 4. Secure base. The child uses the parent as a base from which to launch exploration and personal growth. Fazan and her colleagues surveyed hundreds of people from the ages of 6 through 82, asking which people in their lives fulfilled each of the four defining features of attachment. For example, whom do you most like to spend time with? Whom do you turn to when you are feeling upset? If babies could take the survey, they would nominate mom or dad as the answer to all questions. But by the time they are 8, children want most strongly to spend time with their peers. When children resist leaving their friends to come home for dinner, that's proximity maintenance. Between the ages of 8 and 14, safe haven expands from parents to include peers as adolescents begin turning to each other for emotional support. But it's only at the end of adolescence, around the ages 15 to 17, that all four components of attachment can be satisfied by a peer, specifically a romantic partner. The New Testament records this normal transference of attachment. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. Mark, chapter 10, verses 7 through 9. Evidence that romantic partners become true attachment figures, like parents, comes from a review of research on how people cope with the death of a spouse or a long separation. The review found that adults experienced the same sequence Bowlby had observed in children placed in hospitals: initial anxiety and panic, followed by lethargy and depression, followed by recovery through emotional detachment. Furthermore, the review found that contact with close friends was of little help in blunting the pain, but renewed contact with one's parents was much more effective. Once you think about it, the similarities between romantic relationships and parent-infant relationships are obvious. Lovers in the first rush of love spend endless hours in face-to-face mutual gaze, holding each other, nuzzling and cuddling, kissing, using baby voices, and enjoying the same release of the hormone oxytocin that binds mothers and babies to each other in a kind of addiction. Oxytocin prepares female mammals to give birth, triggering uterine contractions and milk release. But it also affects their brains, fostering nurturant behaviors and reducing feelings of stress when mothers are in contact with their children. This powerful attachment of mothers to infants, often called the caregiving system, is a different psychological system from the attachment system in infants, but the two systems obviously evolved in tandem. The infant's distress signals are effective only because they trigger caregiving desires in the mother. Oxytocin is the glue that makes the two parts stick together. Oxytocin has been oversimplified in the popular press as a hormone that makes people, even ornery men, suddenly sweet and affectionate. But more recent work suggests that it can also be thought of as a stress hormone in women. It is secreted when women are under stress and their attachment needs are not being met, causing a need for contact with a loved one. On the other hand, when oxytocin floods the brain, male or female, while two people are in skin-to-skin contact, the effect is soothing and calming, and it strengthens the bond between them. For adults, the biggest rush of oxytocin, other than giving birth and nursing, comes from sex. Sexual activity, especially if it includes cuddling, extended touching, and orgasm, turns on many of the same circuits that are used to bond infants and parents. It's no wonder that childhood attachment styles persist in adulthood. The whole attachment system persists. Love and the swelled head. Adult love relationships are therefore built out of two ancient and interlocking systems: an attachment system that bonds child to mother, and a caregiving system that bonds mother to child. These systems are as old as mammals. Older, perhaps, because birds have them too. But we still have to add something else to explain why sex is related to love. No problem. Nature was motivating animals to seek each other out for sex long before mammals or birds existed. The mating system is completely separate from the other two systems, and it involves distinctive brain areas and hormones. In some animals, such as rats, the mating system draws male and female together just long enough for them to copulate. In other species, such as elephants, Male and female are drawn together for several days, the duration of the fertile period, during which they share tender caresses, play joyfully, and show many other signs that remind human observers of mutual infatuation. Whatever the duration, for most mammals other than humans, the three systems are strung together with perfect predictability. First, hormonal changes in the female around the time of ovulation trigger advertisements of her fertility. Female dogs and cats, for example, release pheromones. Female chimpanzees and bonobos exhibit enormous red genital swellings. Next, the males become turned on and compete, in some species, to see who gets to mate. The female makes some sort of choice in most species, which in turn activates her own mating system. And then, some months later, birth activates the caregiving system in the mother and the attachment system in the child. Dad is left out in the cold, where he spends his time sniffing for more pheromones or scanning for more swellings. Sex is for reproduction. Lasting love is for mothers and children. So why are people so different? How did human females come to hide all signs of ovulation and get men to fall in love with them and their children? Nobody knows, but the most plausible theory, in my opinion, begins with the enormous expansion of the human brain that I talked about in chapters 1 and 3. When the first hominids split off from the ancestors of modern chimpanzees, their brains were no bigger than those of chimpanzees. These human ancestors were basically just bipedal apes. But then, around 3 million years ago, something changed. Something in the environment, or perhaps an increase in tool use, made possible by increasingly dexterous hands, made it highly adaptive to have a much larger brain and much higher intelligence. However, brain growth faced a literal bottleneck, the birth canal. There were physical limits to how large a head hominid females could give birth to and still have a pelvis that would allow them to walk upright. At least one species of hominid, our ancestor, evolved a novel technique that got around this limitation by sending babies out of the uterus long before their brains were developed enough to control their bodies. In all other primate species, brain growth slows dramatically soon after birth because the brain is mostly complete and ready for service. Only some fine-tuning during a few years of childhood play and learning is needed. In humans, however, the rapid rate of embryonic brain growth continues for about 2 years after birth, followed by a slower but continuous increase in brain weight for another 20 years. Humans are the only creatures on Earth whose young are utterly helpless for years and heavily dependent on adult care for more than a decade. Given the enormous burden that is the human child, women can't do it on their own. Studies of hunter-gatherer societies show that mothers of young children cannot collect enough calories to keep themselves and their children alive. They rely on the large quantity of food as well as the protection provided by males in their peak years of productivity. Big brains, so useful for gossip and social manipulation, as well as hunting and gathering, could therefore have evolved only if men began chipping in. But in the competitive game of evolution, it's a losing move for a male to provide resources to a child who is not his own. So active fathers, male-female pair bonds, male sexual jealousy, and big-headed babies all co-evolved, that is, arose gradually but together. A man who felt some desire to stay with a woman, guard her fidelity, and contribute to the rearing of their children could produce smarter children than could his less paternal competitors. In environments in which intelligence was highly adaptive, which may have been all human environments once we began making tools, male investment in children may have paid off for the men themselves, for their genes, that is, and therefore became more common with each successive generation. But from what raw material could a tie evolve between men and women where one did not exist before? Evolution cannot design anything from scratch. Evolution is a process in which bones and hormones and behavioral patterns that were already coded for by the genes are changed slightly by random mutation of those genes and then selected if they confer an advantage on an individual. It didn't take much change to modify the attachment system, which every man and every woman had used as a child to attach to Mom and have it link up with the mating system, which was already turning on in each young person at the time of puberty. Granted, this theory is speculative. The fossilized bones of a committed father look no different from those of an indifferent one. But it does tie together neatly many of the distinctive features of human life, such as our painful childbirth, long infancy, large brains, and high intelligence. The theory connects these biological quirks about human beings to some of the most important emotional oddities of our species: the existence of strong and often enduring emotional bonds between men and women, and between men and children. Because men and women in a relationship have many conflicting interests, evolutionary theory does not view love relationships as harmonious partnerships for child rearing. But a universal feature of human cultures is that men and women form relationships intended to last for years, marriage, that constrain their sexual behavior in some way and institutionalize their ties to children and to each other. Two loves, two errors. Take one ancient attachment system, mix with an equal measure of caregiving system, throw in a modified mating system, and voila, that's romantic love. I seem to have lost something here. Romantic love is so much more than the sum of its parts. It is an extraordinary psychological state that launched the Trojan War, inspired much of the world's best and worst music and literature, and gave many of us the most perfect days of our lives. But I think that romantic love is widely misunderstood, and looking at its psychological subcomponents can clear up some puzzles and guide the way around love's pitfalls. In some corners of universities, the professors tell their students that romantic love is a social construction invented by the French troubadours of the 12th century with their stories of chivalry, idealization of women, and the uplifting ache of unconsummated desire. It's certainly true that cultures create their own understandings of psychological phenomena, but many of those phenomena will occur regardless of what people think about them. For example, death is socially constructed by every culture, but bodies die without consulting those constructions. A survey of ethnographies from 166 human cultures found clear evidence of romantic love in 88% of them. For the rest, the ethnographic record was too thin to be sure either way. What the troubadours did give us is a particular myth of true love, the idea that real love burns brightly and passionately, and then it just keeps on burning until death, and then it just keeps on burning after death as the lovers are reunited in heaven. This myth seems to have grown and diffused in modern times into a set of interrelated ideas about love and marriage. As I see it, the modern myth of true love involves these beliefs. True love is passionate love that never fades. If you are in true love, you should marry that person. If love ends, you should leave that person because it was not true love. And if you can find the right person, you will have true love forever. You might not believe this myth yourself, particularly if you are older than 30, but many young people in Western nations are raised on it, and it acts as an ideal that they unconsciously carry with them even if they scoff at it. It's not just Hollywood that perpetuates the myth. Bollywood, the Indian film industry, is even more romanticized. But if true love is defined as eternal passion, it is biologically impossible. To see this and to save the dignity of love, you have to understand the difference between two kinds of love, passionate and companionate. According to the love researchers Ellen Burstein and Elaine Walster, passionate love is a wildly emotional state in which tender and sexual feelings, elation and pain, anxiety and relief, altruism and jealousy coexist in a confusion of feelings. Passionate love is the love you fall into. It is what happens when Cupid's golden arrow hits your heart and in an instant, the world around you is transformed. You crave union with your beloved. You want somehow to crawl into each other. This is the urge that Plato captured in The Symposium, in which Aristophanes' Toast to Love is a myth about its origins. Aristophanes says that people originally had four legs, four arms, and two faces. But one day the gods felt threatened by the power and arrogance of human beings and decided to cut them in half. Ever since that day, people have wandered the world searching for their other halves. Some people originally had two male faces, some two female, and the rest a male and a female, thereby explaining the diversity of sexual orientation. As proof, Aristophanes asks us to imagine that Hephaestus, the god of fire and hence of blacksmiths, were to come upon two lovers as they lay together in an embrace and say to them, "What is it you human beings really want from each other? Is this your heart's desire, then, for the two of you to become parts of the same whole as near as can be, and never to separate day or night? Because if that's your desire, I'd like to weld you together and join you into something that is naturally whole, so that the two of you are made into one. Then the two of you would share one life, as long as you lived, because you would be one being. And by the same token, when you died, you would be one and not two in Hades, having died a single death. Look at your love, and see if this is what you desire." Aristophanes says that no lovers would turn down such an offer. Burscheid and Walster define companionate love, in contrast, as the affection we feel for those with whom our lives are deeply intertwined. Companionate love grows slowly over the years as lovers apply their attachment and caregiving systems to each other, and as they begin to rely upon, care for, and trust each other. If the metaphor for passionate love is fire, the metaphor for companionate love is vines growing, intertwining, and gradually binding two people together. The contrast of wild and calm forms of love has occurred to people in many cultures. As a woman in a hunter-gatherer tribe in Namibia put it, "When two people come together, their hearts are on fire and their passion is very great. After a while, the fire cools, and that's how it stays." Passionate love is a drug. Its symptoms overlap with those of heroin, euphoric well-being, sometimes described in sexual terms, and cocaine, euphoria combined with giddiness and energy. It's no wonder passionate love alters the activity of several parts of the brain, including parts that are involved in the release of dopamine. Any experience that feels intensely good releases dopamine. And the dopamine link is crucial here because drugs that artificially raise dopamine levels, as do heroin and cocaine, put you at risk of addiction. If you take cocaine once a month, you won't become addicted, but if you take it every day, you will. No drug can keep you continuously high. The brain reacts to a chronic surplus of dopamine, develops neurochemical reactions that oppose it, and restores its own equilibrium. At that point, tolerance has set in, and when the drug is withdrawn, the brain is unbalanced in the opposite direction. Pain, lethargy, and despair follow withdrawal from cocaine or from passionate love. So if passionate love is a drug, literally a drug, it has to wear off eventually. Nobody can stay high forever, although if you find passionate love in a long-distance relationship, it's like taking cocaine once a month. The drug can retain its potency because of your suffering between doses. If passionate love is allowed to run its joyous course, there must come a day when it weakens. One of the lovers usually feels the change first. It's like waking up from a shared dream to see your sleeping partner drooling. In those moments of returning sanity, the lover may see flaws and defects to which she was blind before. The beloved falls off the pedestal, and then, because our minds are so sensitive to changes, her change in feeling can take on exaggerated importance. "Oh my God," she thinks, "the magic has worn off. I'm not in love with him anymore." If she subscribes to the myth of true love, she might even consider breaking up with him. After all, if the magic ended, it can't be true love. But if she does end the relationship, she might be making a mistake. Passionate love does not turn into companionate love. Passionate love and companionate love are two separate processes, and they have different time courses. Their diverging paths produce two danger points, two places where many people make grave mistakes. In Figure 6.1 in the bonus PDF, I've drawn out how the intensity of passionate and companionate love might vary in one person's relationship over the course of 6 months. Passionate love ignites, it burns, and it can reach its maximum temperature within days. During its weeks or months of madness, lovers can't help but think about marriage, and often they talk about it too. Sometimes they even accept Hephaestus's offer and commit to marriage. This is often a mistake. Nobody can think straight when high on passionate love. The rider is as besotted as the elephant. People are not allowed to sign contracts when they are drunk, and I sometimes wish we could prevent people from proposing marriage when they are high on passionate love, because once a marriage proposal is accepted, families are notified and a date is set, it's very hard to stop the train. The drug is likely to wear off at some point during the stressful wedding planning phase, and many of these couples will walk down the aisle with doubt in their hearts and divorce in their future. The other danger point is the day the drug weakens its grip. Passionate love doesn't end on that day, but the crazy and obsessional high period does. The rider regains his senses and can, for the first time, assess where the elephant has taken them. Breakups often happen at this point, and for many couples, that's a good thing. Cupid is usually portrayed as an impish fellow because he's so fond of joining together the most inappropriate couples. But sometimes breaking up is premature, because if the lovers had stuck it out, if they had given companionate love a chance to grow, they might have found true love. True love exists, I believe, but it is not, cannot be, passion that lasts forever. True love, the love that undergirds strong marriages, is simply strong companionate love, with some added passion between two people who are firmly committed to each other. Companionate love looks weak in the graph referenced in the bonus PDF, because it can never attain the intensity of passionate love. But if we change the time scale from 6 months to 60 years, as in the next figure in the bonus PDF, it is passionate love that seems trivial, a flash in the pan, while companionate love can last a lifetime. When we admire a couple still in love on their 50th anniversary, it is this blend of loves, mostly companionate, that we are admiring. Why do philosophers hate love? If you are in passionate love and want to celebrate your passion, read poetry. If your ardor has calmed and you want to understand your evolving relationship, read psychology. But if you have just ended a relationship and would like to believe you are better off without love, read philosophy. Oh, there is plenty of work extolling the virtues of love, but when you look closely, you find a deep ambivalence. Love of God, love of neighbor, love of truth, love of beauty. All of these are urged upon us. But the passionate, erotic love of a real person? Heavens no. In the ancient East, the problem with love is obvious. Love is attachment. Attachments, particularly sensual and sexual attachments, must be broken to permit spiritual progress. Buddha said, "So long as lustful desire, however small, of man for women is not controlled, so long the mind of man is not free, but is bound like a calf tied to a cow." The laws of Manu, an ancient Hindu treatise on how young Brahmin men should live, was even more negative about women. It is the very nature of women to corrupt men here on earth. Even Confucius, who was not focused on breaking attachments, saw romantic love and sexuality as threats to the higher virtues of filial piety and loyalty to one's superiors. I have never seen anyone who loved virtue as much as sex. Of course, Buddhism and Hinduism are diverse and both have changed with time and place. Some modern leaders, such as the Dalai Lama, accept romantic love and its attendant sexuality as an important part of life. But the spirit of the ancient religious and philosophical texts is much more negative. In the West, the story is a bit different. Love is widely celebrated by the poets from Homer onwards. Love launches the drama of the Iliad, and the Odyssey ends with the lusty return of Odysseus to Penelope. When the Greek and Roman philosophers get hold of romantic love, however, they usually either despise it or try to turn it into something else. Plato's Symposium, for example, is an entire dialogue devoted to the praise of love. But you never know what position Plato holds until Socrates speaks, and when Socrates speaks, he trashes the eulogies to love that Aristophanes and others have just given. He describes how love produces a disease among the animals. First they are sick for intercourse with each other, then for nurturing their young. Note, mating system leads to caregiving system. For Plato, when human love resembles animal love, it is degrading. The love of a man for a woman, as it aims at procreation, is therefore a debased kind of love. Plato's Socrates then shows how love can transcend its animal origins by aiming at something higher. When an older man loves a young man, their love can be elevating for both because the older man can, in between rounds of intercourse, teach the young man about virtue and philosophy. But even this love must be a stepping stone only. When a man loves a beautiful body, he must learn to love beauty in general, not the beauty of one particular body. He must come to find beauty in men's souls, and then in ideas and philosophy. Ultimately, he comes to know the form of beauty itself. The result is that he will see the beauty of knowledge and be looking mainly not at beauty in a single example, as a servant would who favor the beauty of a little boy or a man or a single custom. But the lover is turned to the great sea of beauty, and gazing upon this, he gives birth to many gloriously beautiful ideas and theories in unstinting love of wisdom. The essential nature of love as an attachment between two people is rejected. Love can be dignified only when it is converted into an appreciation of beauty in general. The later Stoics also object to the particularity of love, to the way it places the source of one's happiness in the hands of another person whom one cannot fully control. Even the Epicureans, whose philosophy was based on the pursuit of pleasure, value friendship but oppose romantic love. In De Rerum Natura, the philosophical poet Lucretius lays out the fullest surviving statement of the philosophy of Epicurus. The end of Book 4 is widely known as the Tirade Against Love, in which Lucretius compares love to a wound, a cancer, and a sickness. The Epicureans were experts on desire and its satisfaction. They objected to passionate love because it cannot be satisfied. When two lie tasting, limb by limb, life's bloom, when flesh gives foretaste of delight, and Venus is ready to sow the female field, they hungrily seize each other, mouth to mouth the spittle flows, they pant, press tooth to lip, vainly, for they can chafe no substance off nor pierce and be gone, one body in the other. For often this seems to be their wish, their goal, so greedily do they cling in passion's bond. Christianity brought forward many of these classical fears of love. Jesus commands his followers to love God, using the same words as Moses, with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. Matthew chapter 22, verse 37, in referring to Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. Jesus' second commandment is to love one another. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Matthew chapter 22, verse 39. But what can it mean to love others as one loves oneself? The psychological origins of love are in attachment to parents and sexual partners. We do not attach to ourselves. We do not seek security and fulfillment in ourselves. What Jesus seems to mean is that we should value others as much as we value ourselves. We should be kind and generous even to strangers and even to our enemies. This uplifting message is relevant to the issues of reciprocity and hypocrisy that I talked about in chapters 3 and 4, but it has little to do with the psychological systems I have been covering in this chapter. Rather, Christian love has focused on two key words, caritas and agape. Caritas, the origin of our word charity, is a kind of intense benevolence and goodwill. Agape is a Greek word that refers to a kind of selfless, spiritual love with no sexuality, no clinging to a particular other person. Of course, Christianity endorses the love of a man and a woman within marriage, but even this love is idealized as the love of Christ for his church, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. As in Plato, Christian love is love stripped of its essential particularity, its focus on a specific other person. Love is remodeled into a general attitude toward a much larger, even infinite class of objects. Caritas and agape are beautiful, but they are not related to or derived from the kinds of love that people need. Although I would like to live in a world in which everyone radiates benevolence toward everyone else, I would rather live in a world in which there was at least one person who loved me specifically and whom I loved in return. Suppose Harlow had raised rhesus monkeys under two conditions. For the first group, each was reared in its own cage, but each day Harlow put in a new but very nurturing adult female monkey as a companion. For the second group, each was reared in a cage with its own mother, and then each day Harlow put in a new and not particularly nice other monkey. The monkeys in the first group got something like caritas, benevolence without particularity, and they would probably emerge emotionally damaged. Without having formed an attachment relationship, they would likely be fearful of new experiences and unable to love or care for other monkeys. The monkeys in the second group would have had something closer to a normal rhesus monkey childhood and would probably emerge healthy and able to love. Monkeys and people need close and long-lasting attachment to particular others. In Chapter 9, I will propose that agape is real, but usually short-lived. It can change lives and enrich lives, but it cannot substitute for the kinds of love based on attachments. There are several reasons why real human love might make philosophers uncomfortable. First, passionate love is notorious for making people illogical and irrational, and Western philosophers have long thought that morality is grounded in rationality. In Chapter 8, I will argue against this view. Love is a kind of insanity, and many people have, while crazed with passion, ruined their lives and those of others. Much of the philosophical opposition to love may therefore be well-intentioned advice by the sages to the young. Shut your ears to the siren's deceitful song. I think, however, that at least two less benevolent motivations are at work. First, there may be a kind of hypocritical self-interest in which the older generation says, "Do as we say, not as we did." Buddha and Saint Augustine, for example, drank their fill of passionate love as young men and came out only much later as opponents of sexual attachments. Moral codes are designed to keep order within society. They urge us to rein in our desires and play our assigned roles. Romantic love is notorious for making young people give less than a damn about the rules and conventions of their society, about caste lines, or about feuds between Capulets and Montagues. So the sages' constant attempts to redefine love as something spiritual and pro-social sound to me like the moralism of parents who, having enjoyed a variety of love affairs when they were young, now try to explain to their daughter why she should save herself for marriage. A second motivation is the fear of death. Jamie Goldenberg at the University of Colorado has shown that when people are asked to reflect on their own mortality, they find the physical aspects of sexuality more disgusting, and they are less likely to agree with an essay arguing for the essential similarity of people and animals. Goldenberg and her colleagues believe that people in all cultures have a pervasive fear of death. Human beings all know that they are going to die, and so human cultures go to great lengths to construct systems of meaning that dignify life and convince people that their lives have more meaning than those of the animals that die all around them. The extensive regulation of sex in many cultures, the attempt to link love to God and then to cut away the sex, is part of an elaborate defense against the gnawing fear of mortality. If this is true, if the sages have a variety of unstated reasons for warning us away from passionate love and attachments of many kinds, perhaps we should be selective in heeding their advice. Perhaps we need to look at our own lives, lived in a world very different from theirs, and also at the evidence about whether attachments are good or bad for us. Freedom can be hazardous to your health. In the late 19th century, one of the founders of sociology, Emile Durkheim, performed a scholarly miracle. He gathered data from across Europe to study the factors that affect the suicide rate. His findings can be summarized in one word: constraints. No matter how he parsed the data, people who had fewer social constraints, bonds, and obligations were more likely to kill themselves. Durkheim looked at the degree of integration of religious society and found that Protestants, who lived the least demanding religious lives at the time, had higher suicide rates than did Catholics. Jews, with the densest network of social and religious obligations, had the lowest. He examined the degree of integration of domestic society, the family, and found the same thing. People living alone were most likely to kill themselves. Married people, less. Married people with children, still less. Durkheim concluded that people need obligations and constraints to provide structure and meaning to their lives. The more weakened the groups to which a man belongs, the less he depends on them. The more he consequently depends only on himself and recognizes no other rules of conduct than what are founded on his private interests. 100 years of further studies have confirmed Durkheim's diagnosis. If you want to predict how happy someone is, or how long she will live, and if you are not allowed to ask about her genes or personality, you should find out about her social relationships. Having strong social relationships strengthens the immune system, extends life, more than does quitting smoking, speeds recovery from surgery, and reduces the risks of depression and anxiety disorders. It's not just that extroverts are naturally happier and healthier. When introverts are forced to be more outgoing, they usually enjoy it and find that it boosts their mood. Even people who think they don't want a lot of social contact still benefit from it. And it's not just that we all need somebody to lean on. Recent work on giving support shows that caring for others is often more beneficial than is receiving help. We need to interact and intertwine with others. We need the give and the take. We need to belong. An ideology of extreme personal freedom can be dangerous because it encourages people to leave homes, jobs, cities, and marriages in search of personal and professional fulfillment, thereby breaking the relationships that were probably their best hope for such fulfillment. Seneca was right. No one can live happily who has regard to himself alone and transforms everything into a question of his own utility. John Donne was right. No man, woman, or child is an island. Aristophanes was right. We need others to complete us. We are an ultra-social species, full of emotions finely tuned for loving, befriending, helping, sharing, and otherwise intertwining our lives with others. Attachments and relationships can bring us pain. As a character in Jean-Paul Sartre's play, No Exit, said, "Hell is other people. But so is heaven." Chapter 7. The Uses of Adversity. When heaven is about to confer a great responsibility on any man, it will exercise his mind with suffering, subject his sinews and bones to hard work, expose his body to hunger, put him to poverty, place obstacles in the paths of his deeds, so as to stimulate his mind, harden his nature, and improve wherever he is incompetent. Meng Su, China, 3rd century BCE. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Nietzsche. Many traditions have a notion of fate, predestination, or divine foreknowledge. Hindus have a folk belief that on the day of birth, God writes the destiny of each child upon his or her forehead. Suppose that on the day your child is born, you are given two gifts, a pair of glasses that allows you to read this forecast, and a pencil that allows you to edit it. Suppose further that the gifts come from God, with full permission to use them as you please. What would you do? You read the list. At age 9, best friend dies of cancer. At 18, graduates high school at top of class. At 20, car accident while driving drunk leads to amputation of left leg. At 24, becomes single parent. At 29, marries. At 32, publishes successful novel. At 33, divorces and so on. How painful you'd find it to see your child's future suffering written out before you. What parent could resist the urge to cross off the traumas, to correct the self-inflicted wounds? But be careful with that pencil. Your good intentions could make things worse. If Nietzsche is right, that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, then the complete erasure of serious adversity from your child's future would leave him or her weak and underdeveloped. This chapter is about what we might call the adversity hypothesis, which says that people need adversity, setbacks, and perhaps even trauma to reach the highest levels of strength, fulfillment, and personal development. Nietzsche's dictum can't be literally true, at least not all the time. People who face the real and present threat of their own deaths, or who witness the violent deaths of others, sometimes develop post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, a debilitating condition that leaves its victims anxious and overreactive. People who suffer from PTSD are changed, sometimes permanently. They panic or crumble more easily when faced with later adversity. Even if we take Nietzsche figuratively, which he would have much preferred anyway, 50 years of research on stress shows that stressors are generally bad for people, contributing to depression, anxiety disorders, and heart disease. So let's be cautious about accepting the adversity hypothesis. Let's look to scientific research to figure out when adversity is beneficial and when it is harmful. The answer is not just adversity within limits. It's a much more interesting story, one that reveals how human beings grow and thrive, and how you and your child can best profit from the adversity that surely lies in your future. Post-traumatic growth. Greg's life fell apart on April 8, 1999. On that day, his wife and two children, ages 4 and 7, disappeared. It took Greg 3 days just to find out that they had not died in a car crash. Amy had taken the children and run off with a man she had met in a shopping mall a few weeks earlier. The four of them were now driving around the country and had been spotted in several western states. The private detective Greg hired quickly discovered that the man who had ruined Greg's life earned his living as a con artist and petty criminal. How could this have happened? Greg felt like Job, stripped in one day of all he loved most. And like Job, he had no explanation for what had befallen him. Greg, an old friend of mine, called me to see whether I, as a psychologist, could offer insight into how his wife had fallen under the influence of such a fraud. The one insight I could offer was that the man sounded like a psychopath. Most psychopaths are not violent, although most serial murderers and serial rapists are psychopaths. They are people, mostly men, who have no moral emotions, no attachment systems, and no concerns for others. Because they feel no shame, embarrassment, or guilt, they find it easy to manipulate people into giving them money, sex, and trust. I told Greg that if this man was indeed a psychopath, he was incapable of love and would soon tire of Amy and the kids. Greg would probably see his children again soon. 2 months later, Amy returned. The police restored the children to Greg's custody. Greg's panic phase was over, but so was his marriage, and Greg began the long and painful process of rebuilding his life. He was now a single parent living on an assistant professor's salary, and he faced years of legal expenses fighting Amy over the custody of their children. He had little hope of finishing the book his academic career depended upon, and he worried about his children's mental health and his own. What was he going to do? I visited Greg a few months later. It was a beautiful August evening, and as we sat on his porch, Greg told me about how the crisis had affected him. He was still in pain, but he had learned that many people cared about him and were there to help him. Families from his church were bringing him meals and helping out with child care. His parents were selling their house in Utah and moving to Charlottesville to help him raise the children. Also, Greg said that the experience had radically changed his perspective about what mattered in life. As long as he had his children back, career success was no longer so important to him. Greg said he now treated people differently, a change related to his change in values. He found himself reacting to others with much greater sympathy, love, and forgiveness. He just couldn't get mad at people for little things anymore. And then, Greg said something so powerful that I choked up. Referring to the often sad and moving solo that is at the heart of many operas, he said, "This is my moment to sing the aria. I don't want to. I don't want to have this chance, but it's here now. And what am I going to do about it? Am I going to rise to the occasion?" To have framed things in such a way showed that he was already rising. With the help of family, friends, and deep religious faith, Greg rebuilt his life, finished his book, and 2 years later, found a better job. When I spoke to him recently, he told me he still feels wounded by what happened, but he also said that many of the positive changes had endured, and that he now experiences more joy from each day with his children than he did before the crisis. For decades, research in health psychology focused on stress and its damaging effects. A major concern in this research literature has always been resilience, the ways people cope with adversity, fend off damage, and bounce back to normal functioning. But it's only in the last 15 years that researchers have gone beyond resilience and begun to focus on the benefits of severe stress. These benefits are sometimes referred to collectively as post-traumatic growth, in direct contrast to post-traumatic stress disorder. Researchers have now studied people facing many kinds of adversity, including cancer, heart disease, HIV, rape, assault, paralysis, infertility, house fires, plane crashes, and earthquakes. Researchers have studied how people cope with the loss of their strongest attachments, children, spouses or partners, and parents. This large body of research shows that although traumas, crises, and tragedies come in a thousand forms, people benefit from them in three primary ways, the same ones that Greg talked about. The first benefit is that rising to a challenge reveals your hidden abilities, and seeing these abilities changes your self-concept. None of us knows what we are really capable of enduring. You might say to yourself, "I would die if I lost X," or "I could never survive what Y is going through." Yet these are statements spun out of thin air by the writer. If you did lose X, or find yourself in the same position as Y, your heart would not stop beating. You would respond to the world as you found it, and most of those responses would be automatic. People sometimes say they are numb or on autopilot after a terrible loss or trauma. Consciousness is severely altered, yet somehow the body keeps moving. Over the next few weeks, some degree of normalcy returns as one struggles to make sense of the loss and of one's altered circumstances. What doesn't kill you makes you, by definition, a survivor, about whom people then say, "I could never survive what Y is going through." One of the most common lessons people draw from bereavement or trauma is that they are much stronger than they realized, and this new appreciation of their strength then gives them confidence to face future challenges. And they are not just confabulating a silver lining to wrap around a dark cloud. People who have suffered through battle, rape, concentration camps, or traumatic personal losses often seem to be inoculated against future stress. They recover more quickly, in part because they know they can cope. Religious leaders have often pointed to exactly this benefit of suffering. As Paul said in his letter to the Romans, chapter 5, verses 3 and 4, "Suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope." More recently, the Dalai Lama said, "The person who has had more experience of hardships can stand more firmly in the face of problems than the person who has never experienced suffering." From this angle, then, some suffering can be a good lesson for life. The second class of benefit concerns relationships. Adversity is a filter. When a person is diagnosed with cancer or a couple loses a child, some friends and family members rise to the occasion and look for any way they can to express support or to be helpful. Others turn away, perhaps unsure of what to say or unable to overcome their own discomfort with the situation. But adversity doesn't just separate the fair-weather friends from the true. It strengthens relationships, and it opens people's hearts to one another. We often develop love for those we care for, and we usually feel love and gratitude toward those who cared for us in a time of need. In a large study of bereavement, Susan Nolan Hoeksema and her colleagues at Stanford University found that one of the most common effects of losing a loved one was that the bereaved had a greater